All right, on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC's Understanding Vapor Intrusion, Introductory Concepts and Fundamentals Session 2, which is based on material in the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Toolkit that was released in January 2026. My name is Taylor Vogel, and I will be your moderator for today's training. Many resources from this toolkit will be referenced. Each slide link directs you to the toolkit, which serves as a central landing page for all materials, including fact sheets, tech sheets, checklists, and the technical and regulatory guidance. Jump links on the left side of the toolkit page will help you easily navigate the content. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, is a program of the Environmental Research Institute of the States, a 501c3 education and research nonprofit corporation affiliated with the Environmental Council of the States. We are a national coalition composed of members from state agencies, federal government, tribal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses. Please visit the ITRC website if you're interested in becoming an active member or need to view the full ITRC disclaimer. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review those terms and conditions in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. I now have the pleasure of introducing today's trainers. They have all volunteered time over the years for many ITRC products, including developing and delivering this training today. All right, I am now going to pass it off to Jennifer from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to get us started with today's training.
All right. Hello, everybody. Okay, great. We're seeing the results here of who attended session one of the introductory. So good, 80%. We got about 20% that didn't. We have some more people joining in there. So that's good. Thank you for answering that question. So today, here's our training roadmap. We're going to talk about, I'm going to go over a recap of just how vapor intrusion is different before I pass it on, and another trainer is going to talk about how to assess vapor intrusion. Then we'll go on to talk about managing vapor intrusion risk and then closure and different exit strategies. So I do want to refer to session one of the toolkit on the toolkit that was about the development of the toolkit itself and who should use it. So we want to just refer to the slides three there, the poll results that showed that most people did attend session one. So if you didn't, I would encourage you to go back and listen to session one that was on the understanding of VI, because at that we talked about the VI basic science, although we will repeat quite a bit of that here today. We talked through some common vapor intrusion scenarios, data decisions, and also stakeholder communication. All right, I'm going to turn my video off and move on to the next slide here. Okay, so let's recap. What is vapor intrusion? So we're going to talk about the basic science of VI, and with that, we need to understand what vapor intrusion is and what elements need to be present for vapor to be a potential concern. So what is vapor intrusion? It is the migration of vapor-forming chemicals, or VFCs, from a subsurface source into an overlying building that is occupied or could be occupied in the future. So looking at vapor intrusion from a bottom-up approach, we first need to have a subsurface source of vapor-forming chemicals, either in groundwater, soil, possibly even just soil vapor. That VFC needs to be sufficiently toxic, so we need to have a health risk associated with it. There has to be an indoor air screening level. And there has to be a migration route by which those vapors can be transported from the source to a building that is susceptible to some type of soil vapor entry. And there has to be potential for a receptor. So we have to have inhabited buildings, buildings with occupants, or the potential for there to be future occupants of that building. If any of those things are not present, the VI exposure pathway can likely be screened out. We'll talk about that a little bit more. So let's talk about when a VI assessment might be needed. Like you might have to evaluate that component during like a property transaction, or if there is an investigation going on with a vapor-forming chemical, vapor intrusion assessment is going to be part of that investigation in the soil and the groundwater. And there could be other situations where there's an inhalation exposure that can't be ruled out, where you would need to do a vapor investigation as well. All right, so here is the general overview of the VI strategy. So starting on the dark blue section on the left, we talked in session one about how to determine if the contaminants of concern are sufficiently what we say volatile and toxic to even need a vapor assessment or determine that there is no VI component to even consider. And then as we move to the right, we talked about developing a baseline conceptual site model or CSM and the screening that goes along with that to determine if a building would screen in and need an investigation, or if it can be screened out. And then we talked about where to collect vapor data to evaluate that, along with other what we call lines of evidence, to figure out if there is a vapor risk from either the traditional migration from soil or groundwater up into indoor air of a building, or through what we call vapor intrusion preferential pathways or VIPs, to get into an occupied space. So we also talked about how, if you see on the top green bar, community engagement, we talked about how in session one, community engagement starts at the beginning of a project and continues throughout the entire project. And that means talking with and working with other property owners, tenants, interested neighborhood people. It could include working with the Department of Public Works, Municipal Community Development Department, a local health department, neighborhood interest groups, so on and so forth. Could be community engagement. So today we're going to move further through this strategy into the assessment of the data and managing risk and what that means, including options where we might exit the VI portion of a project, which could happen after investigation if we find that there's no vapor concern. Or we may need to move into mitigation to cut off that vapor pathway that is entering a building and then manage the mitigation that is selected. All right, we want to quickly remind you about regulatory variability across the states. So this will be new for those that didn't see session one, but this graphic is from a publication in 2024. This was also shown a couple of times in the first session. In the vapor intrusion toolkit, specifically in Appendix A, there includes additional details about guidance per state. But the bottom line of this slide is that the rules and guidance really varies across jurisdictions. So we want to be sure to remind you to reference the rules and guidance that are applicable to the state or territory where your specific site is located. But it should be noted that some of the vapor guidance documents, state guidance documents, do include information on just the general science of VI that is independent of the regulatory framework with which it works in. So, such as there could be guidance on vapor transport mechanisms, the historical use of chlorinated solvents, things like the mechanics of mitigation systems, et cetera. But just be aware that there is that variability, and it's important to focus in on what the rules are for the area that you're working in. Right, here are some of the common acronyms that we are going to be using today throughout the presentation. Some of these are maybe familiar from session one, but if they're brand new to you, you maybe don't remember them. So we encourage you to take a screenshot and you can reference this throughout the presentation today. True with any science, you know, there's specific jargon when we're talking about environmental contamination and vapor intrusion. If you have any questions throughout the presentation about what a particular acronym means, just throw that in the chat and we'll be able happy to answer that as we move along. Right, so we're going to take one more poll here. What type of discipline are you representing today? So let's check in with you and see who's joining and please choose the one that represents you the best. So just as we got regulator, health professional, environmental consultant, developer, legal, or other. So regulator could be state or federal. And then just as everyone is answering that, We would encourage participants to ask questions from your perspective, because there will be others on the call that are just like you. And let's see if we can get an answer here. All right, so as we suspected, we primarily have regulators and consultants here, but we also do have some health professionals, developers, legal, and other. Awesome. Good. So we've got somebody from each one of our options representing us. That's great. Welcome, everyone. All right, so we are going to, the next two slides, we're going to go over what makes vapor intrusion unique. This is a little bit of a recap on the first session. So if you have a site that could have an investigation of vapor-forming chemicals, you might have to address vapor intrusion like we talked about. So let's start in the upper left. This is a unique exposure pathway. So we're dealing with the risk of exposure to occupants as a building as they just exist, as they breathe, and they wouldn't expect to be exposed to those harmful chemical vapors. So that's unique in that sense. There's target action or screening levels that are sometimes very low to be protective of the most sensitive population. So we're talking children with large lungs compared to the size of their body, elderly, compromised immune systems, things like that. Also low levels in groundwater that are maybe not an issue for drinking through the ingestion pathway could be a concern for breathing through the inhalation pathway. So if concentrations in indoor air are high enough, we also could have rapid response that might get triggered. And that's talked about more in the VI mitigation training sessions. So let's move over to the upper right. Here in VI, variability is the standard. It is not the exception, talking about vapor data. So vapor data and indoor air data is subject to lots of different variables that will affect the concentrations. There's temporal and spatial variability, time and space, due to weather, seasons, building use, building dynamics. Those change over time. And one of the other things is the indoor to outdoor air temperature difference. So, or like the stack effect. Is it windy? Does the building have leaky construction? Or is it an energy efficient and tight building? Those are all variables that affect the concentrations. Moving to the lower left, the subsurface transport of vapors itself is really complex. Migration of vapors is based on the path of least resistance. So it's affected by the level of volatilization. Does it happen quickly, or does the contamination persist over a long amount of time? Advection is another factor, moving from high pressure to low pressure, and diffusion, moving from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration. So some buildings are pressurized, which affect the potential for vapors to move into a building. And then in any situation, we have to consider preferential pathways. They're a concern when we have things like open sumps, cracks in a building foundation, dirt floor, an open conduit like a floor drain, or if there's maybe a dried out P-trap. Talk about those things a little bit more. And then moving to the lower right, vapor intrusion, that's critical to land use decisions. It's highly influential when we're talking about future site development. Financially, it can affect loans and costs of investigation. It might dictate what type of development is allowed. There could be health risks associated with it. And then when VI is found to be occurring or potentially occurring, there can be long-term management requirements, such as things like operation, maintenance, and monitoring of a vapor mitigation system. Oftentimes, it's really in perpetuity. There's no end date in mind, because the contamination persists for a long time, especially if we're dealing with chlorinated solvents. And there's costs associated with that ongoing mitigation, things like electricity, telemetry operation, consulting costs, equipment maintenance. It could be including ongoing sampling, depending on the regulatory authority that you're in. And the regulatory burden itself of reporting about the operation of that system. Those are all long-term costs associated with that. Those things are discussed in a lot more detail in ITRC's VI mitigation training. That's split also into two different sessions. All right, and we'll just talk a little bit more about some more uniqueness of vapor intrusion. Sampling equipment, that's different than what we're used to with soil and groundwater. We're dealing with evacuated canisters, and sorbent tubes. The units are also different. We're dealing with micrograms per cubic meter instead of like micrograms per kilogram or per liter for soil or groundwater. To the right there, many common consumer products can be background sources for common contaminants in indoor air as well. So that's different than when you're sampling soil or groundwater, whereas if it's not naturally occurring, it's probably a contaminant. That's not true with vapor sampling, where there can be off-gassing from things that we just commonly have in our homes and businesses that complicates the evaluation. The need for communication with stakeholders, moving to the lower left, that increases with vapor intrusion. So we're dealing with property owners and occupants more heavily. They're more heavily involved than with traditional soil and groundwater investigations that happen generally outside of their occupied spaces. And then moving to the right, lower right, there's also the potential for a unique expertise to be added to a contaminant site as a new partner. So we will be dealing with mitigator contractors, electricians, plumbers, and things like that. All right, so we have one more poll here for you. Why is vapor intrusion considered a unique exposure pathway? So just a little bit of a test here. Right off the beginning, is it A, people usually expect to be exposed? B, exposure mainly happens outdoors? C, people can be exposed indoors without realizing it? Or D, it only happens at industrial sites? So, what do you think the answer is based on our little overview here? And then, Taylor, when, oh, perfect. Yay! Right answer, everybody, 100%. Good job. True. People can be exposed indoors without even being able to smell it or realize it or have an acute health effect. So they could be affected by it without being real, without even realizing it. Great job, everyone. All right. So now I'm going to turn it over to our next speaker, Andrew Levitt with California Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC, to talk about how to assess for vapor intrusion. So go ahead, Andrew.
Thanks, Jennifer, for introduction and reminding us how VI is different. So I'm now going to turn my camera back off to save on bandwidth. And we will go to the next slide. All right. So before we discuss how to assess VI, let's quickly refresh our understanding of two very important topics that you may have learned in session one, as they are the backbone of understanding VI at a site. First, conceptual site model, or CSM. This is the picture that tells us what's going on at the property. Think of the CSM as a puzzle where all the pieces are the bits of information that we have. As we further develop the CSM, the picture becomes clearer and we better our understanding of key details like sources, nature and extent, subsurface characteristics, and potential receptors. The CSM is first developed early in the assessment process, even with limited amount of information, but it's not static. The CSM is updated with each new piece of information that we collect. As we evaluate the CSM, we identify missing pieces of information or data gaps, which then drive further investigation. Throughout the life cycle of the project, the CSM helps us make data-driven decisions about investigations, whether or not to screen the site out, VI management, and then ultimately project closeout. And the CSM is also a great tool to convey your understanding of the site to stakeholders and regulatory agencies that are involved in your project. The second concept I want to go over is multiple lines of evidence, or MLE. To better understand MLE, we bring back our friends Eloise and Emily from session one. Lines of evidence, or LOEs, are the data that we collect from your site. MLE is the approach you bring to those pieces of data, building the CSM and helping to answer important VI questions. So where can Eloise and Emily help us? They help us throughout the VI project lifecycle, applying the scientific method to interpret complex data sets and answer VI related questions. We may start with using MLE to help build the CSM and determine if there's a VI concern. But as the project progresses, collection of LOE and the MLE approach allows us to make data-driven decisions by helping us to do things like determine human health risk concerns, support urgent or long-term mitigation measures, determine if VI management is needed, and if so, which strategies are most appropriate, then evaluate the performance of those chosen VI management measures, and ultimately support project closure. The MLE approach allows you to look at the CSM and tie everything together to determine if the VI pathway is complete. When doing this, it is good to turn to use a bottom-up strategy, as shown in Figure 210 from the VI tech rec. There needs to be a source of VFCs in the subsurface media, so you start there. Is a source present? Which media are impacted? How high are concentrations? Or are there buildings that are near the source areas? If not, if the source is not present, VI exposure pathway is likely screened out. If a source is present, then more information is typically needed. If continuing, look for how and where those VFCs are migrating. What are the best routes for those VFCs to move and get into a building? You'll be looking at delineating VFC concentrations, lithology and hydrology, preferential pathways, building design, and when dealing with petroleum compounds, if there are any biodegradation going on in the subsurface. If a completed pathway is identified, you then look at existing or future receptors, like residents or workers. And here, you're going to look at indoor air concentrations, background sources, or seasonal variability. And at this stage, you may also use other information such as forensic data or modeling to answer more specific questions. So we know that assessing VI includes the collection of LOEs and the development of a CSM, but what does that look like in practice? The pathway assessment process starts with a preliminary VI exposure assessment, where existing data is evaluated to decide if a site screens out or has a potential VI concern. If it does not screen out, additional LOEs are collected and evaluated during the VI assessment and evaluation process. We stay in this phase until the site either screens out or moves to VI management. Now, before we dive into these steps, I do want to point out the motivations for starting this assessment at a given site. Excuse me. A property does not just magically appear with some data sets and basic information. You need a reason why the site was identified for assessment in the first place. Typically, that reason is established using initial information obtained prior to the pathway assessment process. The three most common reasons are reports of a spill or release, so think a leak from a UST, which is an underground storage tank, property transactions that may identify historical activities that resulted in a release of VFCs from the environment. Think of a phase one where you identified a former dry cleaner or industrial activity. And then you have regulatory actions like a state agency requesting an assessment for some public health reason. Current or former industrial facilities, dry cleaners, and gas stations are all common types of sites where VI assessments will occur. You may also have an existing larger site with multiple cleanups, where VI is simply one component of the broader project. Assessing VI at a site like this may be part of the current plan, or it may be driven by new information or plan change in the site use. No matter the site's origin story, typically there is a larger goal for the property. It could be cleaning up and maintaining the existing building, or redevelopment of the site into affordable housing, commercial units, or even a park. When initially looking at a site and how it got to the assessment stages, it is important to also keep in mind the design end use. So once the site has made it past those initial steps, it enters into the first stage of the pathway assessment process, which is the preliminary VI exposure assessment. As presented in Chapter 5 of the VI Tech Reg, this is the first of three steps in the VI screening process. During the preliminary VI exposure assessment, you focus on existing site-wide information, such as any existing soil vapor sampling data or historical site uses. We are asking the larger site-wide questions, like are there VFCs on the property or in the subsurface, or are there any existing buildings? You'll use the answers to determine if there's a potential for VI. If not, the site can likely screen out of the VI assessment process. If the answers indicate a potential VI concern, we move to steps two and three, where we perform initial and then refined building-specific evaluations. And a site can screen out during those steps two and three, should the data indicate there's no VI threat. However, if you cannot determine if a site poses an unacceptable risk or cannot eliminate the site from further evaluation, then we keep on going down the VI pathway assessment process. And the next step is VI assessment and evaluation. So this is where we evaluate the CSM, identify all the data gaps, conduct investigations to fill those gaps, evaluate data against risk-based screening levels, and use the MLE approach to interpret data within the site's CSM. The goal is to collect enough data for confident decision-making. Does the site screen out, or does the data indicate the need for VI management? This question you're going to hear me repeat several times over the next 45 minutes or so. Remember that this may be an iterative process. An investigation may fill in one data gap, but leave another unresolved. So this is a simplified version of Figure 6.1 from the toolkit. Like everything in the toolkit, we broke the VI assessment and valuation stage into multi-step process, in this case, four steps. The flow chart picks up after step three in the screening process. When you enter the VI assessment and evaluation stage, step four is to choose your investigative approach. Once chosen, you design the investigation work plan in step five. In step six, you implement that work plan, after which you evaluate the data in step seven. At the end of your evaluation, you must decide if more information is needed, and if not, whether the site screens out of the process or moves to VI management. As I mentioned on the previous slide, this four-step process is often iterative. You may end up going through the cycle several times until you are able to make those data-driven decisions. So let's get into each of these steps. So first, in step four, you choose your investigative approach, but this is not simply deciding on how to conduct a single investigation. During the step, you are deciding on the broader approach you're going to take for the site overall and how it's going to be evaluated. You're using the initial CSM to develop your data quality objectives, or DQOs. These are the initial questions to ask to determine which media needs to be investigated, whether to use a phase or progressive approach, which is shown, or as shown in 6.2 from the toolkit, Figure 6.2, where to start your site investigation. If you have a building on your site, is there a source under the building? A common strategy is to start away from the building and move inward to ultimately assess the VI pathway for completion. If you've gotten to step four for the first time, the site didn't screen out of the preliminary assessment. It means there's enough information and data suggesting a potential VI concern for the site. To choose the investigative approach, reviewing the VI CSM is vital. Even if it's limited, this evaluation will direct your next steps. And that is where our friends Eloise and Emily come back in. We use the MLE approach to review all of the LOEs that make up the CSM. That's right, I used all three acronyms in one sentence, and after this training, you should be able to also. To complete this review, we again use the bottom-up approach. First, looking at the existing subsurface data, followed by the existing or planned building characteristics, then ultimately, if the site has any investigatory, mitigation, or remedial history. Petroleum-based vapor intrusion, or PVI, can bring its own unique challenges to the investigative process. Petroleum hydrocarbons are known to be easily degradable under aerobic conditions, which is when there's sufficient oxygen in the subsurface. Therefore, ITRC, US EPA, and most states are using the separation distance approach to evaluate PVI. As shown in the figure on the left, if the only source of vapor is dissolved in groundwater, a site may be screened out if there's a minimum of 6 vertical feet of clean soil between the bottom of the building and the top of the water table. As shown on the right figure, if free phase product called light non-aqueous phase liquid, or an LNAPL, is the source of vapor, then 15 vertical feet of clean soil is needed between the source and the bottom of the building. Regulatory agencies also recommend a lateral exclusion distance of 30 feet. In other words, the building's edge is 30 feet away from the edge of the vapor source. If a building doesn't have adequate vertical and lateral separation distances from the source, additional data is needed, so it moves on in the investigative process. It should be noted that all sites may be screened using separation distances, but those distances are much shorter when dealing with PVI. Another important step, a part of step four, is a selection of sample media. This is a simplified version of Table 6.1 from the toolkit. It presents the advantages and disadvantages of sampling various media. The five primary media are soil, groundwater, soil vapor, subslide vapor, and indoor-outdoor air. And each one has its own advantages and disadvantages. For example, soil allows you to get lithologic information, but the data cannot be used to assess VI since concentrations don't account for mobility or actual concentrations in the vapor phase. Groundwater can be evaluated as a potential source, but it may be a weak predictor of VI exposure. Subslide vapor are both commonly sampled for VI assessments, and sample collection is easy, but an attenuation factor needs to be applied to estimate indoor air, and both can be very intrusive. And then sampling indoor-outdoor air is the most direct way of measuring exposure concentrations. However, it can be disruptive and easily affected by background sources. Once you've chosen the investigative approach, we design the investigation itself in step five. Here, we develop a work plan that includes all the details needed to complete the proposed investigation. The work plan should include details like the identification of data gaps, sampling locations, sampling and analysis plan, how the data will be evaluated, and even address things like background sources and community outreach. Once drafted, it should be submitted to your overseeing regulatory agency for approval. And I do want to point out the caveat that not all sites are under regulatory agency. So for those sites, all of these aspects may be incorporated into a proposal document for a client. Data gaps may be the most important part of step five, as they are the key drivers in further investigations. Identifying data gaps is where steps four and five bleed together. You evaluate the CSM in step four, and by step five, you are identifying the LOEs that are missing. Filling those data gaps become your DQO, which in turn drives your investigation. So each work plan serves as a proposed strategy for addressing said gaps. And this strategy should be designed with that purpose in mind and clearly stated in the work plan. Your scope of work should not be random. Sampling media, collection methods, locations, analytical methods, they all should be designed so the data is addressing that gap. So to demonstrate how you may design an investigation, I'm going to present a couple of case examples. First, we'll design a scope of work for a VI investigation at an office building that previously had industrial activities that resulted in the release of VFCs to the subsurface. Data collected to date identified VFC concentrations in soil vapor well above screening levels, including under the building, but a complete VI pathway remains a data gap. So, how do we design a scope to address that data gap? Well, we don't want to collect air and vapor samples randomly. The investigation should be targeted to best address that gap. When trying to assess a complete VI pathway, you may start with some common sampling locations. So first, you may look at the primary work areas, then suspected vapor entry points or preferential pathways. Floor penetrations such as utility conduits or cracks in the slab often serve as potential preferential pathways. So bathrooms are common focuses of these investigations. Next, if there's lacking a sufficient amount of data in the source area, you may add a location there. With some initial locations in mind, you can now start asking yourself some key questions to complete the proposed scope of work. In this case, you may ask if we need paired subslab vapor samples. Some states prefer paired air and vapor data when investigating the VA pathway. Then we ask if outdoor air samples are needed. Here we go. Then we ask if outdoor air samples are needed. The number and placement of outdoor air samples will vary in some states. For example, California agencies prefer outdoor air samples to be collected upwind, downwind, and crosswind. And then finally, we're going to look at the map and make sure that we have an adequate amount of coverage. For the second example, let's look at a multi-unit commercial building with a former dry cleaner. Like the first example, data collected to date identified VFC concentrations in soil vapor well above risk-based screening levels, including under the building, but the complete VI pathway remains a data gap. To address this data gap, here is the final scope that you submit to your regulator. But how did we get there? Well, again, we start by looking at common sampling locations like primary working areas, a source area, and suspected vapor entry points. Then we ask ourselves key questions. Are there any data gaps that may warrant additional sample locations? Are paired subslab vapor samples needed? Are outdoor air samples needed? Are all of the initial sampling locations realistic? Some businesses, say a nail salon, use hazardous substances. That will result in a higher level of background sources, so you may not want to collect indoor air samples in those units. Another unit may not be accessible because of ongoing activities or just the size of the doorway to get a drill rig inside. You may even come up with an initial scope, and after reviewing it, you just realize some of these locations are just overkill. These are all important questions to ask yourself so the final proposed scope has purpose. So, with the work plan submitted and approved by your agency, you can move to the implementation of that investigation in step six. This is the actual field work where you collect the LOEs. Collect samples that are analyzed by a laboratory or in-field detectors and analyzers. Be sure to complete all pre-field activities like creating a health and safety plan, getting any necessary permits or access agreements, or coordinating with subcontractors like the lab. And maintain good communication with your project team and any other stakeholder that require updating. And we'll go over a little more detail on investigation activities in a bit. Once all the samples have been analyzed and the data obtained, you move to step seven, data evaluation. Here, the individual data sets are generally evaluated first against risk-based screening levels and then to see how it fits in to the broader CSM. The goal of evaluating data is to see if it successfully filled the targeted data gap so we can make the next data-driven decision for the site. and Emma will have more on data evaluation later in the training. After step seven, we once again screen the site. Is there enough data to move the site on from the evaluation process? If so, does it screen out or do we move to VI management? If not, we presume that more data is needed to fill in any remaining data gaps. This is where, again, the process becomes iterative. The screening stage acts as a bridge back to steps four and five, where you reevaluate the CSM, identify additional data gaps, and again design a scope of work to address said gaps. With this iterative process, each time you go through these steps, the puzzle moves closer to completion. Additional LOEs helping to refine CSM until you understand all impacted media, the vertical and lateral extents, subsurface characteristics, the source area, mitigation, sorry, migration pathways, sensitive receptors, calculated risks, and the list goes on. The cycle will continue until again, we have enough data to make a decision on the site, screen out, or move to VI management. So we have a poll. We're going to ask everyone, what does multiple lines of evidence or MLE mean in a VI evaluation? The silence. All right. Excellent. Excellent. So, yes, the correct answer is C. We combine different types of data to understand the site. We are collecting all of those LOEs and using the MLE process to assess them and build that CSM. Great. Now let's dive a little deeper into investigation activities. Since sample collection is one of the most most integral parts of the evaluation process. Most investigations include the collection of media samples, and each media has its place in a VI evaluation. For example, as I pointed out earlier, while concentrations of VOCs in soil may not be useful to predict VI exposure, lithology information collected during the sampling process can play a key role in determining contaminant migration or an appropriate remedy. Air and vapor are the most commonly sampled media when evaluating VI, and there are several different collection tools and methods we can use. Today, I'm going to discuss the two most common kind of tools slash methods for sampling these media. But for more details on all of the available tools, you can refer to Chapter 7 of the VI Tech Rec. So let's start with active soil vapor and subslab vapor sampling, which I'll shorten by just saying vapor sampling. By far, this is the most common method for collecting vapor samples because they are relatively easy to collect and the data is accepted by regulators for human health risk assessment. Active vapor sampling requires the installation of either a temporary or permanent probe and an active mechanism to move the vapor, like a pump or hand-powered syringe or the vacuum from a sampling container. Typically, active vapor sampling has a short collection time, although there are exceptions, and includes a series of leak checks and purging. And it's important to understand these procedures when you're sampling. Samples are collected in evacuated canisters, commonly just called SUMAs, as shown in the bottom right photo, or sorbent tubes, as shown in the top right. Once collected, these samples are usually sent to a fixed lab for chemical analysis. However, active vapor sampling is commonly analyzed by a mobile laboratory. These vapor samples still include purging and leak checks, but are then collected in a typically collected in a glass syringe and analyzed by a mobile lab in the field. And it should be noted that grab samples can be collected from these subslab and regular soil vapor probes using active methods such as a syringe to collect a sample from a vapor probe and having them analyzed by a portable GC or a gas chromatograph if you have one in the field. But the data is often considered qualitative or at least semi-qualitative, and the acceptance will vary from state to state. As with vapor, active sampling is the most common method for collecting indoor and outdoor air because the collection process, again, is easy and the data is accepted by regulatory agencies for human health risk assessments. Like vapor, active air sampling requires a mechanism to move the air into the canister or sorbent tube. Unlike vapor, active air sampling requires no purging or leak checks or probe installation. You simply place the sampling vessel in the desired location and open the canister or turn on the pump. Typically, sampling times are 8 hours for industrial or commercial sites and 24 hours for residential. But these can be adjusted to accommodate site-specific concerns. Say you have a commercial or industrial facility where everyone works a minimum of 10 hours. You may want to adjust that to 10 hours. To ensure the samples are collected over the specified time, lab program flow controllers are attached to the sampling canisters during collection. And then if you're using sorbent tubes, the pump is set at a targeted flow rate. While this applies to all forms of indoor air sampling, not just active, some state regulatory agencies require the collection of outdoor air samples simultaneously. While the collection process is the same as indoor air, practitioners may want to keep in mind additional considerations like the tree drip lines or the distance away from a building. Also, it's good practice for field personnel to conduct a building survey during the indoor sampling event. This allows you to record potential background sources like chemicals being used or preferential pathways like cracks in the slab. So, passive air and vapor sampling is the other common collection methodology. It relies on diffusion of VFCs onto a sorbent material without the use of an active mechanism like a pump or vacuum. The resulting concentrations are meant to represent natural conditions. And it's important to make sure you're picking out the right sorbent material for your targeted VFCs. Now, for passive soil vapor, the sampling device is placed into a shallow boring, typically 2 to 3 feet, and left to collect for over a week or two. For passive air, like active, the sampling device is simply placed into the desired location and left to collect up. But the difference here is it's left to collect for periods ranging from a week to several months. Advantages of passive sampling include easy deployment, less intrusive, and potentially lower cost. Passive is also ideal for conduit sampling like sewers or collecting vapor samples in soils with low permeability. However, most states currently do not accept passive soil vapor sample for data for risk assessment, and sorbent samplers are not good for collecting fixed gases. It should be noted that most labs that analyze passive samplers can report the data in micrograms per cubic meter, and also acceptance of passive soil vapor data is for risk assessment is evolving. And it should be noted, I did say passive soil vapor data. Passive air data is often accepted for risk by many regulatory agencies. So procedures for active and passive sampling are well established in several state and federal guidance documents. Some of these documents are listed here, including Chapter 7 and several fact sheets of the ITRC VI Toolkit, the EPA's Vapor Intrusion Technical Guidance, and ITRC's Passive Sampling Tool Guidance. Examples of some state guidance documents include Cal EPA's Active Soil Gas Investigation Advisory and New Jersey's VI Guidance. Additionally, the ITRC VI team created a YouTube playlist that includes great videos on performing many aspects of VI investigations. In addition to the more common vapor and air sampling tools, there are several supplemental VI investigation tools that can provide integral information during the assessment process. These tools are commonly used for more specific site assessment needs and scenarios, like collecting forensic data to differentiate between chemical sources, data collected for VI modeling, finding preferential pathways, identifying VI patterns, assessing building-specific data, and then lithology slash plume delineation. While not always, many of these tools can be more expensive and often require specialized technical professionals to help design and implement the fieldwork, then interpret the data. Also, many of these tools provide non-chemical specific data that may only be accepted as qualitative or in some cases semi-qualitative. I'm not going to go into detail about each of these tools, but the ITRC toolkit includes fact sheets for many of them, and a list of links for those fact sheets are provided on this slide. I will just run through a few of these tools and what they're used for. So they include compound-specific isotope analysis, which is used to differentiate chemical sources. There are tracers, which are used to assess building-specific attenuation factors and VI migration. Building pressure manipulation, which can be used to differentiate sources of indoor air. So think VI versus background sources for that. There's real-time monitoring, which is great for identifying vapor entry points and VI patterns. Flux chambers used to capture chemical flux into buildings. High-volume sampling used to support and design mitigation measures, particularly in large buildings. And in situ, which means in ground, in situ soil profiling tools, which are used to identify lithology, vertical delineation, and the presence of napal. It should be noted that sometimes these tools can be combined to collect multiple LOEs in a single mobilization. For example, when doing real-time monitoring with a portable GC unit, field personnel will also utilize a pressure monitor and weather data to better assess VI patterns. So with that, I want to wrap up this portion of the training with a quick case example that demonstrates how we completed a site puzzle using several tools at our disposal. This example utilizes high-resolution site characterization, which is not considered a traditional approach. So when you're looking back at that, determining your approach, and we had a phased version, that wouldn't be phased. This would be kind of a more progressive approach. It capitalizes on completing a complex field investigation by collecting a higher density of samples, using multiple sampling technologies, and adjusting project stages based on the data collected to date, which includes the data collected during the various stages of this multi-phase investigation. The site is a former plating facility on a large four-building property in Southern California. A property transaction triggered an initial discovery investigation that included the collection of soil and soil vapor samples using active methods. Data indicated tetrachloroethylene, or PCE, and trichloroethylene, TCE, in soil vapor and soil exceeding that concentrations exceeding screening levels. The site was entered into a voluntary cleanup with a state agency. The entire project team, including the responsible parties, the consultants, and the agencies, they all got together and to design a large multi-phase investigation to further characterize the site. Passive vapor sampling was used to delineate the lateral extent, and MIHPT slash CPT was used to delineate the vertical extent. The lateral extents are shown in the figures on this slide. The MIHPT and CPT data gave us the lithologic and hydrogeologic data and told us where VFC concentration peaks were vertically. For this site, it indicated that VFCs continued into groundwater at concentrations above screening levels, which was then confirmed by grab groundwater samples. The combined data was used to decide on final locations and depths and depth intervals for permanent soil vapor probes, subslab probes, and groundwater monitoring wells. which were all sampled using active sampling methods. The passive and active subslab data was then also used to decide which buildings required indoor air sampling, which was completed using active collection methods. All of these phases were completed in about 5 months. It should be noted that indoor air indicated some more urgent human health risk concerns, so short-term VI management measures like air purifiers and fans were set in place, and there'll be more about those kind of measures later on in the training. But in this case, confirmation sampling indicated they weren't working. So we used real-time monitoring and were able to identify numerous cracks as preferential pathways. And once those were sealed up, indoor air concentrations were greatly reduced, allowing the project team to focus on more long-term cleanup. So as you can see, it often takes the use of several investigation tools to build that robust CSM for the site. So with that, we enter our first question and answer period.
All right. Yes, thank you, Andrew. We've now reached our first Q&A break of the training. And before I ask a couple questions to our trainers, we did want to note that there is a typo on slide 23, the flow chart with the red arrows, the no and yes for the answer to does the site screen out? They should be switched, and we will switch this in the slides and re-upload them to the Clueing training page. Okay, so the first question I have for our trainers, have you experienced any challenges with sampling during the rainy season? Also, could those conditions interfere with vapor suppression?
Oh, definitely. Most states, if not federally, have a requirement of how long you need to wait. Typically, I think 48 hours. Some states may have 72 after what they define as a significant rain event, which I believe is a half an inch or more. And then, there are some exceptions if you're sampling subslab inside of a large building with a huge slab, a state agency may be maybe willing to give a variance on that just because it's likely not affected right under the slab. But that's kind of a case by case basis. And yes, rain can certainly affect the concentrations. Any wet weather, or wet conditions. So not just rain, but moist soil in general. Anyone else have something to say on that?
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, we just had another question come up in the chat. How about snow cover specifically or freezing conditions? And how does that affect VI intrusion or sampling? I figured it would be a little similar to what you just responded to.
I really wish that I that that's funny.
I can
when we
take
were
that
writing
one.
chapter seven, it took us a while to find this because we had to find someone from either, yeah, I think either Jen, you may have, or someone from Alaska may have. But there is something in chapter seven about snow cover and freezing conditions. But Jen, yeah, you may know.
Right. I mean, so I'm located in Wisconsin. Frost conditions for many months are very common. It absolutely affects vapor intrusion, but it does also matter what your land cover is, and what your soil type is. So, in a situation where you have tight, wet clay with a shallow water table, it's less affected by when you have frost conditions. But generally, frost conditions, heavy snow cover, thick frost, those all act like an impermeable surface. So, like a land cover, like concrete or asphalt or another building or so forth. So, it is important that you evaluate a building for vapor intrusion under different seasons because it's very different when it's, 80 degrees in the summer and a still quiet day and you have no land cover versus when the ground is completely frozen with, a couple of feet and It's acting like there's no vegetation in the area. So definitely impacts it and should be assessed in all those conditions.
And keep in mind that both will affect just the sampling process itself. So, you may install a probe and you've logged your soil and it looks fine. And then you go out and it's raining, maybe not significant, but maybe you got a little bit of moisture and that's going into the ground. And now all of a sudden you go to collect that vapor sample from your probe and it's vapor locked, which is a term we use for basically you're pulling on the sample and nothing's coming out, or maybe water's coming out. Or in the case of extremely cold conditions, it's just frozen, even 5 feet below. So.
And I did want to comment too that rain events have the potential to cause fluctuating water table. So in areas where there is a shallow water table, it could absolutely affect the subslab vapor as well, where maybe you have 7 to 12 feet for the water table, and then you have a significant rain event that elevates the groundwater level and that can affect your subslab vapor concentrations and your indoor air as well. So it's more than just porosity that it affects. It's also the subslab vapor.
All right. Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Jennifer. In the interest of time, I will continue with the training. But thank you all for continuing to interact with that Q&A pod. We will have one more opportunity to answer questions live at the end of our training today. But I will now turn this over to Emma from the US EPA, who will discuss data evaluation.
Thank you, Taylor. can you? Okay, thank you. So next, we're going to see how we can get soil vapor and air samples analyzed and evaluate the data to make a conclusion on VI risk. Next slide, please. So to get sample analyzed, there are usually two types of analytical instruments we can use. One is portable field methods or tools, such as handheld PID or FID. These tools can be non-chemical specific, such as a handheld PID we use quite often in the field. It provides a lump sum concentration of all VOCs that it can detect in the vapor phase sample. These tools can give an idea how much total VOCs are there in the sample. They're also much more complex portable field instrument that can provide chemical specific concentrations. A HAPSITE GC-MS is such an ex is an example for that. Overall, these portable tools are easy to use in the field, providing a general idea of the VOC concentration level in the sample quickly, and they are great for quick field screening. Sometimes can help make decisions right there in the field. For example, it can help to find where hot source zones are or to decide if there should be any step out for sampling. But their limitations are also very obvious. For example, they usually have less stringent QAQC, and most of them may not be suitable for quantitative risk assessment. But they can inform us about CSM or can be used as one of the line of evidence. More information can be found in 2025 ITRC VI toolkit VI real-time monitoring fact sheet about the portable field screening methods. Another type of analytical tools are offsite fixed lab or mobile lab in the field. Shown here in the picture is a mobile lab in the van with instrumentation inside. The analytical methods associated with these complex instrumentation are usually approved by governmental agencies. Commonly used lab methods are listed here for vapor phase samples. For example, TO15, TO17, ASTM M1946. These analytical tools can also be chemical specific or non-chemical specific. The method selection is dependent on data collection objectives, QAQC requirements, required target analyte list, and applicable regulatory screening levels. So, for example, modified 80-60 method can be used to analyze VOCs in vapor phase samples. But this method usually has high method detection limit that can often be higher than the stringent indoor air screening levels. So for indoor samples, TO17 or TO15 are used more often. When we select an analytical method, it is always good to connect with the lab before going to the field. Comparing the lab analytical methods to portable field tools, lab analytical analysis requires sample handling and shipping and usually has a longer turnaround time. But they do have more stringent QA/QC, so the data from these methods are defensible. They're suitable and acceptable to be used as primary line of evidence and often can be used to quantify VI risk. So once we got the lab report or data included in the report has been submitted for review, then sample data should be reviewed carefully. The purpose of this review is to identify if there are any issues in the sample data to determine if this data can be used for further VI risk evaluation. Here are a list of questions that should be asked while reviewing the vapor phase sample data. First one is that are these data analyzed consistently with the work plan and with the chain of custody? And any deviation from those needs to be well understood and documented. And the second one is there any data indicating air leakage? Usually you review the records of final gauge pressure on sewer canisters or check the leak test, the le checking the data on leak testing compounds in the soil vapor samples. If data indicate leakage, then you can ask yourself, hey, can this data be used for VI evaluation later? And there are also questions about lab report. For example, is there any issues with sample or lab QA/QC procedures? And are the data flagging from the lab well understood? All these needs to be answered without any doubts. And for vapor phase sample, unit conversion is very important. So vapor samples will usually have unit of microgram per cubic meter, which is different from we are used to, such as milligram per kilogram or ppm, even milligram per liter. So we need to make sure our unit conversion is correct. Last but not least is, are the reporting limits of the risk driver compounds higher than risk-based screening levels? Once the data are reviewed and qualified for further data evaluation, then we can then start the interpretation of the data to draw conclusions about VI risk. More details on data reviewing can be found in the ITRC VI Toolkit fact sheet and checklist listed at bottom of the slide. All right, once we determine data collected are good enough for further VI risk evaluation, we now can do data interpretation. The objective of data interpretation is to answer these two basic questions. One, compare data to the existing CSM. See if the data can fill the data gap and/or refine and complete the VI CSM. So in this case, if there are data found to be unexpected based on current understanding of the CSM, then it's very important to find out why. Because it could mean some misunderstanding of the existing CSM and maybe more data is needed. And secondly, compare the risk-based screening values and make decisions about VI risk. So in this process, we may run into scenarios where data is so ambiguous that it's hard to draw a confident conclusion on VI risk. In this case, we may need to collect more data or we may need to use all lines of evidence to make a decision based on the multi-line evidence approach. So, for example, if indoor benzene concentration exceeds the screen value, but is that true that VI is occurring? Or do we have other data to prove it is not VI related or it is VI related? So, in this example, we may need to combine outdoor air data and/or subset soil vapor data to make a decision. And if those data are not even available, then we may need to collect more data. More details about data interpretation can be found in Chapter 8 in 2025 ITRC Vapor Intrusion Technical and Regulatory Guidance listed. The link is listed at the bottom of this slide. So, as mentioned previously, when practicing VI investigation and risk evaluation, one commonly encountered scenario is a comparison of indoor air concentration or soil vapor concentration to their risk-based screening values cannot draw a clear conclusion about VI risk. So to help us to draw a conclusion with more confidence, multi-line of evidence approach is often needed. As Andrew has mentioned before, MLE approach means that pulling all different lines of evidence together and make more confident data-driven conclusion on VI risk and answer these questions with confidence. One, is VI occurring in the current site situation? If yes, what should be the next? Should we do mitigation right now? And then, is VI likely occur in the future? And some of the line of evidence used in the multi-line evidence approach for VI are listed here. As you can see, there are quite some lines of evidence here from VI CSM components to forensics analysis to building pressure control test. But not all lines of evidence are available at a specific site. And even they're available, not all lines of evidence are helpful to draw conclusions in specific cases. So more information on multi-line of evidence approach can be found in the ITRC VI Toolkit, multi-line evidence fact sheet. The link is listed at the bottom of the slide. All right, now we're going to give an example of using multi-line of evidence to draw a conclusion on VI at a petroleum-impacted site. So as shown in the figure here, it is a residential home built on a former UST site. The living space has a crawl space foundation, and the attached garage has a slab-on-grade foundation. A very shallow groundwater plume is under the building, and the depth to groundwater is about 1 to 3 feet below ground surface. We have done multiple runs of VI investigation and have ruled out preferential pathways, seasonality, and identifiable and removable indoor air sources were removed during all these investigations. So every time we would get similar benzene concentration distribution as shown on this figure. Indoor air, crawl space, outdoor air have similar benzene concentrations. Garage air is a little higher, and the only subslab soil vapor benzene, soil vapor's sampling port benzene concentration is under the garage is about 10 times higher than the garage air. And benzene in indoor air, outdoor air, crawl space, of course, they're higher than the stringent state indoor air residential screening levels. So the question has always been, is the benzene in living space in the garage from the subslab soil vapor under the garage, or is it from an indoor source? To answer this question, multi-lines of evidence approach was used with all available lines of evidence. And some lines of evidence cannot provide definitive yay or nay answer to the question of is indoor air benzene from background source? So for example, based on the CSM, we know that remediation work was done in the past and the current shallow groundwater under the building doesn't contain any benzene above lab detection limit. So from the CSM standpoint, it supports the idea that indoor air benzene may be from background source, but not quite definitive. There are a few other lines of evidence that do help us to find the answer. The first one is the chemical inventory data, which indicated that there are still non-removable benzene source in the garage and living space. And number two is spatial variability of the benzene in the vapor phase in different areas also point to that benzene in the living space and crawl space could be coming from the garage. Number three, we calculate attenuation factors for all chemicals detected both in the subslab soil vapor sample and the garage air sample. It is found out that the cross-slab attenuation factors for Betex were significantly higher than those for other compounds, which clearly indicate that there were indoor and background source in the garage that is confounding the data. Number four, finally, the outdoor air, indoor air, and crawl space air are within the range of background benzene concentration range found in the background studies in that region. So using these lines of evidence in a multi-line of evidence approach at the site, it is concluded that benzene detected in living space and a garage is more likely from background sources than from the subsurface as a result of VI. So in the previous slides, we have talked about comparing sample data to screening values to draw conclusions about VI risk at a site. So in a real project, VI risk assessment is conducted in two ways. One is to directly compare the chemical concentration in indoor air or soil vapor to published risk-based screening values. This is usually the first way we choose because it is easy and quick. And there are different screening values for different COCs in the different media for different receptors. So, for example, we have soil gas screening values versus indoor air screening values, residential indoor air screening values versus commercial indoor air screening values. So we need to be careful when we are choosing the screening values to do the comparison. And although the screening values are risk-based, they're usually very conservative as they're developed to consider to be protective for even the most sensitive people like children. So usually if when we compare vapor phase data screening values below the screening values, usually means that no further action is needed. But exceeding screening values does not mean there is a human health risk from VI. It only means more information is needed to make a final decision on VI risk. And 2025 ITRC VI Toolkit has a screening value calculator fact sheet that contains more information regarding this topic listed at the bottom of the slide. And another way to conduct a VI risk evaluation is calculating inhalation risk based on the exposure point concentration of the chemical, which is usually the indoor air concentration of that chemical in VI risk evaluation. The indoor air concentration can be directly measured in indoor air, derived from other data like from soil and groundwater, or even from modeling. And after risk assessors perform a whole bunch of calculations based on exposure concentration and the toxicity of that chemical, and a risk screening level is calculated, considering both cancer or non-cancer health risk effects. And then the calculated risk level is compared to risk thresholds established by regulatory agencies. And conclusion about vapor inhalation risk due to vapor intrusion can be drawn based on that comparison. And the accepted risk thresholds vary by state, and so should be verified with the agency before doing any risk assessment. And given an example, US EPA risk thresholds for cancer risk is that if you're over 10 to the minus 4, it's an unacceptable risk. If it's less than 10 to the minus 6, then it is acceptable risk. In between, that means you need to evaluate site-specific. And for non-cancer risk, usually calculated as a hazardous quotient, if it's bigger than 1, that means risk is unacceptable. And there are more details can be found in US EPA Human Health Guidance. Now it's time for a knowledge check. And the question is, what does it usually mean if a VI screening level is exceeded? A, immediate evacuation is required. B, a health risk is confirmed. C, more evaluation or information is needed. D, the site can be closed. All right. Okay. Oh, wow. So more than 80% people get the right answer. C is the correct answer. So as we mentioned before, risk-based screening values are quite conservative. So below that usually means no further action needed. But exceeding it does not even mean there is a VI risk confirmed. It simply just means that we need more information or use multi-line evidence approach to draw the conclusion. So of course, sometimes if the detected concentration in indoor air are extremely high, then maybe immediate action or emergency response might be needed. With that, it concludes this part of the training. Next, Andrew will use more examples to reinforce the iterative process of VI investigation. So, Andrew.
All right, so before we wrap up on how to assess BI, let's look at a case example that again reiterates the nature of the assessment evaluation process. So the site is a multi-unit commercial building that formerly housed a dry cleaner. A very limited discovery investigation was completed as part of a property transaction, and PCE was identified in sub-slab vapor probes. At concentrations exceeding screening levels. So the owner entered into a cleanup agreement with the state agency. So how would the assessment and evaluation process look? Well, first, you complete the preliminary VI assessment, pathway assessment, where you review any existing data. This site does not screen out, so you enter the four-step assessment and evaluation process. Step four, review the initial CSM and choose an investigation approach. In this case, the property owner and their consultant chose the more traditional phased approach. The consultant designs an initial investigation based on existing LOEs and data gaps. In this case, you are starting with a very limited data set, just two sub-slab vapor probes. So at this early stage, you have lots of options about what you want to sample. Let's see, is it clicking? There we go. All right. If you're in an area with shallow groundwater, you could start by collecting groundwater samples. Or you could start with just collecting soil vapor outside of the building. You could also collect more subslab vapor samples. And then finally, you can go straight to indoor air and collect those samples. While there are some extreme situations where this may happen, you should know that generally you won't go straight to indoor air. So after choosing and designing the first investigation, of course, after and receiving approval on the work plan, you'll move to step six, where you conduct the investigation, followed by step seven, evaluating the data. And then after the evaluation, you notice that data gaps remain. So back to step one, sorry, back to step four. You repeat this cycle until the project team has a clear understanding of the CSM, so a decision can be made for the site. Does it screen out or does it move to VI management? So if we look at the site in map view, we can start going through the multiple rounds of the assessment and valuation process. So we start with the original data from the two initial subslab vapor probes, as shown as the C in the legend on the left. Based on the data gaps, our initial investigation includes subslab vapor samples, as shown as the Bs, to delineate the plume laterally, and additional subslab probes to make risk decisions for the building. The results suggest the need for indoor air sampling, and delineation remains incomplete as well. So you design and conduct another investigation. This one probably more robust, and this includes indoor air sampling, as shown as the Ds, and additional soil vapor sampling. The results indicate no VI concern, but you still haven't delineated the plume completely. So a fourth investigation is completed to laterally delineate the northern and southern extents of the plume, and you also drill a deeper boring near the source area to try and find the vertical extent. From that boring, we grab an initial, we collect a grab groundwater sample as shown as the A, and then the results of that investigation show VFCs have made it to groundwater. So a fifth mobilization is likely needed to install and sample groundwater monitoring wells. Now, in the real world, you may not have this number of sampling locations. This is simply meant to demonstrate the iterative nature of the assessment process, to show you that after an investigation, questions may remain. And when they do, additional investigation and data evaluation is needed. Every site will be different in some way. For example, if this was a petroleum site, you wouldn't collect soil vapor samples to delineate the PVI plume, or sorry, the PVI source. All right, so with that, we have another question, another poll question. Which statement best describes the vapor intrusion assessment process? And the answer is yes, B. All right. Almost all of you got B. B is the answer. It is often iterative and refined as new data are collected. Remember, as I said several times in this training, an investigation may answer one question or several questions, but leave other questions unresolved. All right. So instead of a typical summary of everything we just discussed about how to assess VI, I want to briefly discuss how some of what we talked about today addresses many of the challenges we encounter when evaluating VI. Many of these challenges were presented in VI 101 session one, and they really can be broken up into two categories, technical and what I'm calling public. So first, the technical, these challenges include the complexity of VI transport, high concentration variability, difficulty in identifying preferential pathways, conservative screening that leads to conservative decision making, and differentiating between background sources and on or ongoing activities and VI. The investigation and evaluation tools we discussed today can be used to address most of these challenges. It may take more investigations, but these questions can typically be answered. Maybe more active vapor and/or air sampling is needed to address a data variability problem. Having trouble figuring out transport, passive soil vapor sampling may help. Can't distinguish between VI and background sources? Well, try tracking concentrations and differential pressure patterns using real-time monitoring. Now, what I'm calling the public challenges. These include community outreach, the public's understanding, gaining access to places that need sampling, things like that. All of these can be addressed with better community engagement. Begin your outreach early and engage often. Make sure everyone is heard and don't use typical technical language when you're talking or trying to explain something to non-technical people. In keeping with the toolkit theme, think of evaluating VI as something in your home that needs to be fixed. To fix it, you need to find the right tool. When it comes to evaluating VI, our toolbox is large and has tons of options. Sometimes it's just a matter of figuring out the right one. So with that, I will hand it over to Susan to discuss managing risk and closure and exit strategies.
Thanks, Andrew. Hello, everyone. Here we are back at our training roadmap. Now we're going to focus on the last two circles, managing VI risk and closure and exit strategies. Managing VI risk refers to the steps that you're going to take to address exposures that can cause harm to human health and the environment. Closure refers to getting regulatory buy-off for those steps. We're going to combine these into one section because it's really important that they're done together because different states have different requirements for managing risk. And you want to be sure that the exit strategy you choose to eliminate risk as much as possible is agreed to by the state so you can get closure for your project. Thank you. So let's talk about managing VI risk. The health protective closure requirements for your site are going to depend on the results of your risk assessment, how it fits into your state's expectations and regulations for closure. The means of achieving the protective nature is going to depend on a lot of other things. For example, your liability tolerance. While it might be okay to leave contamination in place, anything that you remove will reduce liability. Technical aspects, because complete cleanups are rarely possible, and also your future site goals. For example, the minor cleanup at a site that will remain a manufacturing facility is probably going to be different if there's a huge paved parking lot than what you might want to leave behind where a residential neighborhood is planned. There are many possible paths to get to that VI protective closure, but most of them are going to involve a combination of remediation, mitigation, or site controls. So let's go over these terms and see how they fit together. Remediation reduces contaminant mass. Three common are digging, which is physically removing contaminated soil, injections, which are ways to reduce contamination by injecting some sort of treatment from above ground into the ground, and it turns your contaminants into more benign products. And then extraction systems, which remove volatile contaminants by mobilizing them towards a treatment system. Now, let's suppose you had a structure in the vicinity of this last type of remediation. You can see that while being removed, the vapors are also being routed away from the structure. Rerouting vapors away from where people may be is mitigation. Let's compare. While remediation removes contamination, the goal of mitigation is to keep contamination from reaching receptors at harmful levels. In other words, you want to limit or prevent exposure by cutting off the pathway where the vapors were migrating. Mitigation usually does not clean up contamination except for a small subset like the extraction system that we just talked about. While both offer health protections, states are going to differ in their requirements. For example, in some states, you may be required to do remediation if concentrations are above a certain level. In others, only mitigation may be okay as long as you've reduced the exposure to levels below which a health effect would be expected. Excuse me. Many sites will have both components because the goal is different. Since remediation time frames are longer and mitigation can be accomplished pretty quickly, you may need to mitigate exposure while remediation is ongoing. Remediation cleans up long term, while mitigation protects in the short term. Similarly, it's an important distinction because you want to make sure stakeholders know what to expect. It's important to understand that a mitigation system that's installed without remediation is likely going to run for a really long time because it doesn't clean up the contamination to any extensive degree, and you want to make sure that people understand that. Conversely, if remediation is implemented in addition to mitigation, it's important that stakeholders understand that the mitigation system may be eventually turned off if the remediation is successful. You don't want any surprises when you show up to turn off the system. Thanks, Taylor. So let's have a little example of here's PIC. It's the most common mitigation system. This is a sub-slab depressurization system. There's many variations, but they all look about like this. So these systems will have some piping beneath the structure with vent ports, an applied fan. You can see a little picture of the fan in the middle of the pipe, creates a vacuum between indoor air and the contamination beneath the slab. The vacuum keeps contamination from reaching indoor air above screening levels. Any contaminated air that is collected to create the vacuum is going to be vented above the roof. You can see the little pipe above the roof where it's vented. But the main function of the system is to work as a vacuum barrier. Now you can see how this could be easily confused with a remediation system. But these systems, even though they have a fan, it's a much smaller fan and or than an active remediation system would have, and it doesn't actively clean up contamination. Collected contamination is generally minimal because the fan is so small. Some states will base your mitigation requirements on indoor air concentrations, while others will base the decision on subslab concentrations and the potential for indoor air to become contaminated. And likewise, the type of mitigation system and implementation procedures is going to vary from state to state. Chapter 10 of the VI Toolkit goes into mitigation in much greater detail. The VI Toolkit has many fact sheets, and they're really helpful to understand the multiple kinds of mitigation systems. ITRC also has a two-part vapor intrusion mitigation system training that I would strongly recommend if you want to develop a greater understanding of mitigation. So here's time for a little poll. What is the main goal of vapor intrusion mitigation? To remove all contamination from soil and groundwater? To prevent vapors from getting into buildings at levels of concern, to replace remediation activities, or to eliminate regulatory oversight. Woohoo! Very good. Everybody got that answer right. The main goal of mitigation is to reroute the vapors away from where people are living. You want to make sure that they're not getting into the building at levels of concern. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about land use controls. At vapor intrusion sites, land use controls are legal instruments that outline what must or must not be done at a property to protect from vapor intrusion. They're generally grouped into two types, institutional and engineering controls. Institutional controls are administrative or legal measures that, such as a zoning restriction or a legal notice or a deed restriction. These controls manage vapor intrusion by limiting land or resource use. So maybe your site's risk assessment showed that levels are inappropriate for 24-hour occupancy, but an 8-hour commercial exposure was fine. A control may be restrict to commercial on the deed or zoned commercial by the local zoning body. If things are fine right now, but subslab is high, a control may be that any structural changes to the building would require a reevaluation. Engineering controls outline physical or mechanical processes that are needed to keep protective measures functioning. For example, an engineering control would outline what must be done to keep a mitigation system protective. For example, check the fan, check the vacuum gauge, future sampling, any operations, maintenance, and monitoring that was needed for the system. So, since controls are legal instruments, states are generally going to have much different requirements in what is allowed and who has authority to implement and who is responsible for maintaining. Some states have implementation authority. It's frequently, but not always, the responsible party's requirement to enact controls. But for example, a property owner must usually consent to a deed restriction. You can see why it's important to spell out who is responsible for completing each measure if you want the controls to keep on working. So, Chapter 11 emphasizes that land use controls and long-term stewardship requirements must be clearly defined, enforceable, and commensurate with the residual risk to ensure that continued protectiveness exists over time. When you think about all this, you'll see that controls frequently require action from somebody other than the responsible party. For example, the zoning board may be needed to prevent residential development. The responsible party may need to work with homeowners to place a deed restriction on their property or understand what operations, monitoring, and maintenance is needing. All stakeholders need to understand what is happening. Because of this, community engagement must continue through this phase of the project. So let's talk a little bit about that. Your site community engagement system is going to be important because for systems and controls to remain protective, I need to advance to the next slide. There you go. Things that must be done or not done need to be not only documented, but also communicated. Concerns must be addressed to make sure everybody's on board with the plan, because the plan isn't going to work or be protective if stakeholders don't understand and commit to their responsibilities. For vapor intrusion measures to remain health protective in the future, everyone has to understand their role, including future property owners and tenants. A common oversight in vapor-related projects is the amount of time that's necessary to engage stakeholders and to maintain those relationships throughout the entire project. If relationships aren't built and maintained as the project progresses, it's going to be really hard to implement what needs to be done for your exit strategy. Chapter 3 of the VI Toolkit main document and also the VI mitigation training systems go into community engagement in a lot more detail. But I kind of wanted to just emphasize it here because that communication is a huge part of the long-term protectiveness from VI. Now let's talk a little bit about what is closure. Closure is generally written recognition that you have a plan that the state environmental agency is happy with. Closure documents will have different names, timing, and requirements, and different states, and also within a state, they might have different names if there's a different cleanup for different cleanup programs. They might be called a no further action letter, a covenant not to sue, a certificate of a completion. But what they all have in common is that the state agrees with your protective exit strategy. Closure doesn't necessarily mean you don't have to do anything else. No further action simply means the state is not pursuing any further action or imposing any further requirements for the responsible party if they do what is in the plan that was agreed to. If there are continuing obligations in the plan, it must be spelled out how they will be met in the future. Make sure that these things are done and the state won't add any other responsibilities. Closure requires a well-defined conceptual site model, and most states will have a caveat that if something was missed or conditions unknown at the time of closure are discovered later, the state reserves the right to revisit obligations. So closure is the goal, so you know potential harm to human health and the environment have been addressed. In this training, we focused on closure for vapor intrusion, but remember, you're going to have other pathways on your site which may also need to be addressed. Let's have a few final words about what some different types of closure might look like. Here's our strategy overview slide from earlier in their presentation. The exit strategies are on the bottom row. The orange highlighted exit ramps on the left indicate that near the beginning of your project, like we talked about earlier, it was determined that either there was no current VI risk at the site, or maybe you had some buildings screen out pretty quickly because there was no VI risk. As long as the state agency agrees, you would be able to get written closure for vapor intrusion for the site, or maybe for the individual screened out structures, depending on the state agency. Now let's look at the highlighted arrow on the far right, which would be more at the end of your project. Maybe you've done substantial remediation and you reduced the vapor concentrations to below those health protective levels that we talked about earlier. If the state agrees, you would get closure certification from the state. These two cases are a special type of closure that's referred to as unrestricted closure. Unrestricted closure for VI means no continuing obligations regarding VI, as contaminants are expected to be present or migrate at levels which could potentially cause harm to human health and the environment. You can develop as you wish on the property with no stipulations. It's usually denoted by meeting residential standards, but you're going to want to check your state's guidance to see where that determination is made. For some states, it's in indoor air. For some states, it may be subslab concentrations. Other site paths, such as soil and groundwater, may have restrictions associated with them on your site, even though the vapor intrusion does not. And finally, like I said earlier, most states have a caveat that if something was missed and it's found in the future, the state reserves the right to reopen the project. Now let's talk about the other type of VI closure, which is managed VI closure. This is where the potential for vapor intrusion risk remains on a site. Managed closure is defined in Chapter 11 as a risk management decision framework that allows site reuse while maintaining regulatory oversight and clear exit criteria for future evaluation or system curtailment. In simpler terms, you're allowing a site to be used because you've made and implemented decisions on how to protect stakeholders from vapor intrusion. You have a plan in place to continue these protections into the future as long as needed. So, with managed VI, while the potential for vapor intrusion remains, you've reduced exposure to acceptable levels by one of the means that we talked about earlier, such as mitigation or land use controls. The measures protect from vapor intrusion health effects, but if the mitigation system doesn't continue to run or the controls aren't honored, there's a potential for VI health risk. You have to manage how these responsibilities will continue in the future to get closure from the environmental agency for your project. Managed closure of the state's environmental contamination case is going to require documenting that any needed protective institutional or engineering controls are in place. For example, a deed restriction must be filed with the county courthouse. You also need to document responsibilities for any engineering controls, including continuing mechanical and financial obligations concerning the mitigation system. For example, who is responsible for making the fan is working? Who's going to pay for a new fan? What happens if a property is transferred? Plus, many other things must be spelled out and communicated. ITRC's vapor intrusion mitigation training goes into this in a lot more detail, so you might want to check it out. Many of the legal requirements are state or local laws, so it's really important to be aware of regulations in your project's location. In addition to environmental project managers, legal and finance departments may also be involved to ensure that the chosen management is both legally defensible and financially solid. One thing that doesn't vary is the need for a comprehensive plan. A successful health protective managed closure relies on ensuring responsibilities are spelled out and that they're delegated in a detailed plan that's going to allow you to both get closure from the state for your project and then also be sure that people are protected from vapor intrusion, both now and in the future. Another little knowledge check. What does site closure related to vapor intrusion usually mean? The regulatory agency agrees that the vapor intrusion risks are addressed with an approved plan. All contamination has been completely removed from the site. The site no longer needs to be monitored by anyone. No vapor intrusion was ever present at the site. Most people got it right. The correct answer is actually A. Closure doesn't really mean there's nothing else to do unless it happens to be unrestricted closure. So you just need to understand that the regulatory meaning of closure is that the state has agreed to what your plan is, that it will be protective. So, it doesn't always mean that cleanup is complete. It means that there's just an agreement that risks are being managed in a health protective way. So, this has been a really brief, high-level overview of vapor intrusion. And ITRC has many trainings that go into a lot more detail. It sounds like most of you participated in the VI 101, and now you've got a link to go review that if you didn't. There's also a vapor intrusion YouTube playlist that has some really cool videos that shows you how to sample and do some other things that are on the toolkit website. And as I mentioned a couple times, the vapor intrusion mitigation session trainings, there's two sessions to it, is a really great way to learn more about vapor intrusion mitigation. So now I think we have another question break.
Alrighty. Thank you, Susan. And as Susan mentioned, we are now at our final Q&A break of the training. And then I will go ahead and wrap it up after we ask a few live questions to our trainers. The first one I have is for Andrew. Why is there so much variability in how case managers treat similar sets of data? Specifically in California, I often see similar sets of data treated completely differently depending on the experience of the case manager. Any recommendations to communicate these discrepancies to agencies?
So the simple answer is yes. Next question. Just kidding. Yes, this is a problem, especially here in California. We have, at bare minimum, we have two larger regulatory agencies under Cali PA. On top of that, we have county and local regulators as well. So this is a problem. I think it's a problem all over the country. As regulatory agencies have been hiring, newer and less experienced people. And it's just a matter of training them up. In California specifically, we've been working on a series of workshops that start for the public and then will be done internally to make sure that everyone's on the same page and that everyone has the same understanding of how to look at, data and the various investigation options and things like that. So, what I would say is if you are dealing with a regulator who is handling data differently from, say, other regulators that you've experienced in your career, maybe, in a nice way, ask to bring in some technical support. And within California, at least, that, we should be able to kind of get on the same page. And if you want to take part in the next California workshop, Cali PA workshop, I believe you can still sign up. And that actually is tomorrow, I believe. No, sorry, Thursday. There you go. That's what I got.
All right. Thank you, Andrew.
I hope that helps. I know it can be frustrating.
Right. And then I think this question will be to Susan or Jennifer. Can you talk about how long we should typically be monitoring rebound concentrations after turning off a remediation system? What if we keep seeing increasing concentrations after turning the system off?
You're always going to want to monitor the rebound, and different states do have different time frames in their guidance. I think generally at least 6 months after a system, and then you're going to want to look at your data and see what's actually happening with it and then decide whether that was long enough or not. If your trend is still increasing, then you're going to want to keep monitoring until it's either stable or starts decreasing.
Yeah, and I think that I'm not sure that that question was intended to be remediation system or if they meant mitigation system, but either
Oh.
way, either of those would be beyond the scope of our general vapor intrusion type of training. But I would, say there's other factors, just generally I'll throw out there that there's other factors that could be at play there. If you're doing an injection like a remediation and you're having like reductive dechlorination happening, you could be seeing an increase in a daughter product where the parent product is maybe decreasing. So maybe there's still some chemical reaction going on there. Or you could have desorption happening. Once you've addressed the contamination that's in solution, there might be some stuff that's desorbing. So, anyways, pretty complicated stuff. Lots of reasons for that. But if it was specific to mitigation, shutting that off and seeing rebound, that's a question that can be asked again at the ITRC's VI mitigation training.
All right, thank you, Susan. Thank you, Jennifer. And I currently don't see any more questions open in the Q&A pod. So I will go ahead and start wrapping up this training. If I do see another one pop up, I will pause. But thank you again to our expert trainers and our subject matter experts, for being here today and presenting this training and helping with the Q&A in the background and for their contribution to the ITRC document. And we would like to hear back from you, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide, and I also dropped it in the chat. Filling out the feedback form and certifying you that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, please feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. All right. Thank you, everyone. We look forward to seeing you at more of our trainings in the future. Bye, everyone.